In this episode, we talk about losing a child. If that's not something you're interested in hearing, you can stop the episode around 41 minutes.
I've had some illnesses that I probably shouldn't have survived. Car wrecks I probably shouldn't have survived.
Paul Templar has almost died so many times, it seems like he's most comfortable right at the edge. He had a waterborne parasite attack his kidneys as a child. He was almost murdered by poachers in 1991, has traversed minefields, survived a hurricane on a boat. But this isn't any of those stories. This is a story about surviving and surviving and surviving.
What do you think attracts you to, or back then attracted you to, situations like that?
I have given this quite a bit of thought as I've gone through life. And I don't think early on it was necessarily conscious. I think there was part of it that was just good old fashioned. It was exciting and seemed like a good idea and not entirely thought through. And a sense of maybe invincibility. And there's this cliche, it talks about an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I think there was a little bit of that in play.
Sure.
I felt that I needed to keep proving, actually not to anyone else, it was more to myself.
Paul grew up in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, in the middle of the Rhodesian Bush War, which is also called the Zimbabwe War for Liberation.
It's funny, it was a long time ago, and I can probably remember elements of that more clearly than I can remember what I was doing last week. But mostly because of the feeling. There was this feeling, this connection to life, because it could be extinguished at any moment. And because I was a kid, that became normal. Mm-hmm. When I look, I have two kids here in the States, and the thoughts of them going to school in an armored personnel carrier and having soldiers with them because there was a above average chance they'd get ambushed, and driving past friends' farms and seeing the farmhouse on fire because they had been attacked.
After he got out of school, Paul went into the British Army, got out of the British Army, moved back to Zimbabwe, and started a career on the Zambezi River as a safari guide.
Safari guide was actually a misadventure. I'd wanted to get into the marketing side of the tourism industry in Zimbabwe. And the people who gave me a job said I should go and learn about the product by going on safari. And I just absolutely fell in love with it. So instead of my office being in sales venues and conference centers for the next few years, it was out on safari. It ignited a passion, and I absolutely loved it.
The job wasn't without its dangers.
Hippos are fairly territorial, and some of them develop a reputation just because of some of their characteristics. I'd launched this new company, and it was actually on our very first trip. This was an interesting hippo. He had attacked my canoe and knocked us into the river. But it was, as far as hippo attacks go, it was a very gentle attack. He had just come up under the boat, knocked it over, and a little bit of chaos when I was trying to rescue some of the people in the water. But it was more a scare attack, it felt. But over the course of the next 6-8 months or so, he kept attacking. And each attack got a little more violent, a little more aggressive. And I was his first attack and his last attack.
This is Live to Tell, the podcast where I talk to some of the bravest people who have been through the most horrifying things and lived to tell the tale. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. One day in March of 1996, Paul got up thinking he would be doing some animal control.
There was a pride of lion that had been making a nuisance of themselves. They were attacking and eating some of the local villages near Victoria Falls. And we were supposed to be going in with a team that day to take care of the problem.
But that didn't end up working out. So Paul was free to help out a river guide friend who came down with malaria. Paul agreed to fill in for him on a guide trip.
I knew that stretch of the river probably as well as anyone and relished the opportunity to go and lead a safari. So I said, sure. This particular trip was one of my favorites. It was called the Royal Drift. It was a stretch of river just above Victoria Falls. And the idea for it was everyone, all the clients, would literally just sit back, relax, and be paddled down the Zambezi River. As you went down, the sun would be setting and Victoria Falls would be just ahead of you and the mist would be coming up. It was just glorious. And the wildlife. There was everything you would want to see. Yeah, there was the possibility of elephant, buffalo, hippos, crocodiles, all sorts of antelope, water buck, kudu.
I don't know that I would want to see a crocodile.
Right. And I'm not saying you would see all of them on every safari, but there was always the possibility of it. And the idea was we would go in these Canadian-style canoes.
What does that mean?
So if you think of like a traditional canoe with three seats, one in the back, one in the middle, one in the front, they're about 18 foot long. And the way we would run the trip is we would have a client sitting in the front, a client sitting in the middle, and then we would have a guide sitting in the back, usually with a cooler box in front of him. And as we would drift down, the clients would say, I'd like a snack, please. There would be trays of snacks and, or they would ask for a gin and tonic or a glass of wine or, and it really was meant to be a luxurious drift down the river.
Paul's team consisted of three other men, Mac, Ben, and Evans. They were taking out six clients that day, two in Paul's canoe and two each in Ben and Evans' canoes.
They were good at what they did. They were almost done with their apprenticeship. So off we went, and it was a glorious day. And we came across this pod of hippos. They were just laying in the water, sunning themselves. There's usually someone in the group who's read up in hippos and asks about them being the most dangerous animal in the world. And so we talked a little bit about that, about statistically that, yes, they are responsible for more human fatalities than any other animal. So we got that out of the way, but then we got to look at them and their social grouping and their social gathering, and they're really cool. And you could see there were baby hippos and mom hippos, and on the side there was the dad hippo, and it was just really cool. But what I knew as a guide was you don't want to get too close to that.
As an experienced guide, Paul knew how to navigate this situation.
Once we got about as close as I wanted to get, I pulled our group together and laid out my plan of evasive action. Over the years, I'd learned to read the water, and I knew that if we stuck to the shallow water, we'd be fine. Mm-hmm. And once we got past the hippos, dropped into this set of kind of narrow channels, it was just so pretty. The sun setting and the mist from the falls, it was just glorious. And as I dropped in the channel, I turned to make sure that everyone was where they were supposed to be. And sure enough, the canoe behind me was right where it was supposed to be. The safety kayaker was right behind him. But the third canoe had fallen back a bit. So I just set my paddle down and waited for him to catch up.
Paul enjoyed this moment of peace, but it didn't last long.
There was this loud, like, this crash. And my stomach sunk. I knew that sound all too well. It was the sound made when a hippo hit a canoe. So I turned around just in time to see the canoe was kind of up in the air. There was a hippo underneath the back of it. It had hit it. One of my apprentice guides, the guy who was paddling that canoe, Evans, was kind of flying through the air. And somehow the canoe managed to fall back down upright. But now Evans was in the water. And I could see like a mum hippo and her baby. And I could see some other young hippos in a pod. And this was a stretch of river that was full of very big crocodiles. So there was a lot that could go wrong rather quickly. So first things first, I needed to get the clients from Evans's boat out. So Ben, one of my other guides, I said, Ben, go rescue them.
And they were still in the boat.
They were still in the boat, yeah. And Ben did exactly what he was supposed to do. He went and rescued the clients. There was this rocky outcrop, so that was going to be our safety point. So let's get everyone to that. I didn't have time to drop off my clients because Evans really needed to be rescued.
Yeah.
And so I started paddling towards him, yelling towards him. He was looking appropriately freaked out. There's a lot of adrenaline going on. I was paddling towards him frontwards. And then as soon as I got close, the plan was I turn around. So the back of my canoe pulls up next to him. I reach over, he grabs my hand. That was the plan. But just before I got to him, I noticed this. If you've watched any of the old war movies where a torpedo is shot towards a ship, you can see this bow wave coming in towards it. That's what it looks like when you've got a hippopotamus charging in towards your boat. Fortunately, I'd learned over time that if you slap the water with the flat blade of your paddle, it makes a loud noise, and that's usually enough to turn the hippo around. And so I did that, and the wave dissipated. Whew, I was relieved. Pulled up next to Evans, leant over, and I was leaning over to grab a hold of his hand. He's stretching up, and as our fingers almost touched, the water between us just erupted. Everything just went dark and strangely quiet. And a few seconds ticked by, and I was trying to figure out what was going on. I couldn't see anything, and I was trapped. I couldn't really move my top half of my body or my arms. And I could feel this incredible pressure on my lower back. And it was weird because everything was going in slow motion as I was trying to figure this all out. Then I managed to move one of my hands just far enough. And I felt the bristles on a hippo's snout. And I had this moment of, oh, I know exactly where I am. I'm up to my waist on a hippo's throat. I think the most absurd part when I look back at that was my first reaction was relief, because I wasn't up to my waist on a crocodile's throat. For some absurd reason, I thought I had a better chance of getting away with a hippo. That was a pretty fleeting thought, though. It quickly returned to, oh, crikey, I got to get out of here.
Yeah, it's still not good.
Still not good. But I really couldn't do anything. I was just clamped down so tightly. But then I'm guessing I'm not a small guy, and me down the hippo's throat can't have been comfortable. Some kind of gag reflex, maybe. But the hippo opened up his mouth long enough for me to, like, pull myself out. I burst to the surface and took a lung full of fresh air, and I came face to face with Evans, the chap who I'd been trying to rescue. And I was like, we got to get out of here, man. And I could see the rock where Ben and Mac were and the other clients, and it was doable. I started swimming towards that, and then I got the spidey sense that all was not well, and I turned and looked back for Evans, and he wasn't going anywhere. His eyes were like saucers as he struggled to stay afloat. I mean, I know now that terror and panic had completely overwhelmed him from a neurophysiological point of view. He was in shock. And
yeah.
So I turned back and tried to grab a hold of him in your classic lifesaver's hold when, wham, I was hit from below.
The hippo came up from under him, mouth open, and now had paused legs in its mouth.
And the hippo starts thrashing me around, and I remember trying to grab a hold of my gun, and I couldn't even do that. I was being thrashed around so much.
Yeah, but, and hippos don't eat people. So he's just trying to kill you.
He's just trying to break me. He's just trying to kill me. And that's the thing with hippos and their attack style is it's destroy. Just tear it apart, break it. And that's what this hippo was trying to do. As this is all going on, all I'm managing to do is not drown, but the hippo throws me out again. Again, I think feet first down his throat, not that comfortable. Come up, look around, no sign of Evans. So I think for sure Mac or Ben must have come and rescued him whilst I'm busy distracting this hippo. So I start swimming, and I'm making pretty good progress until truly one of the most disconcerting moments of my life when I come and I take a stroke and I take a breath and I just see this hippo charging in towards me with his mouth wide open as he zeroes in, and then he scores a direct hit. And now from my thighs down are outside one side of his mouth, and from my chest up, I'm outside the other. And his tusks are boring through me.
The hippo had him right around his torso.
One of the clients said it was like watching a vicious dog trying to rip apart a rag doll. I remember at one point he threw me up into the air, and I did this crazy sort of half twist, and somehow he managed to catch me in pretty close to the same position, and then bit down so hard that I felt like I was going to get bitten in half. When we went underwater, I would hold my breath. And when we were on the surface, I would suck in air. And after a while, I figured out that if I held onto the tusk as the hippo thrashed me around, my flesh didn't tear so much.
But then the hippo dove down to the bottom of the river and stayed there.
We were maybe in 6 feet of water. And I remember laying there, pinned inside his mouth with his tusks boring through me, and looking up, and I could see the different hues of green and yellow. I could see the sunlight shimmering on the water's surface. And as I looked around, the water was pretty clear. I could see my blood mingling with the water, and wondering if I'd bleed to death or if I'd drowned. And then thinking, I wonder who can hold their breath the longest.
Hippos can hold their breath for around 5 minutes.
The hippo and I were just, it was this weird sort of pause in a dance. We just lay on the bottom of the river. Hippo went to the surface again, spat me out, and this time the front of the safety kayak, my friend Mac, who to this day, I can't believe the courage it took for him. Watching all of this, he paddled in to try to rescue me. And I was able to grab a hold of the handle on the boat's nose, and we took a bunch of hits, but Mac hung in there and he dragged me to relative safety. Mac pulled me into these rocks, so he pulled his kayak up onto it and half helped me, and I kind of pulled myself, still having a ridiculous amount of adrenaline coursing through my body. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking across at the clients and I'm like, all right, folks, you need to stay calm. Everything's going to be okay. And they were just like looking at me like dead man walking. They were just staring at me like, did you see what just happened to you?
Paul took a brief moment to assess the state of himself.
I was a mess. Starting at the bottom, my one foot looked like someone had tried to beat a hole through it with a hammer. The hippo's tusk had gone through my foot and torn through the back of my Achilles. Tusks had gone through both of my shoulders. My left arm, from the technical term is degloved, the top part had been completely shattered, as had the bottom part, and it was barely still attached. So Mac did what he could. He tore his shirt. He had this brand new safari shirt on. He's still a little pissed about this. He tore it up and he did whatever first aid he could. He kind of put me back together.
His left arm was so damaged, most of the muscle had been torn away and he could see his bones.
That was not good. There was a part that was both disappointed and relieved. Because there wasn't blood pumping out. So I thought the artery's intact, but it didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. So the strategy was roll my sleeve down, button it up, keep the arm attached, minimize the movement.
Kind of, if I can't see it, it's not happening.
A little bit, yeah. I tried to talk, and instead of words, blood started bubbling out of my mouth. And we knew that to be a guide, you have a lot of really extensive and advanced paramedic training. So we knew I had what's called a tension pneumothorax, a punctured lung, and chances of living weren't really good at that point. So Mac took the saran wrap with a plate of snacks and used that to seal the wound, stop my lung from collapsing and me from dying right there.
even in his state, Paul was still in charge and had to get his clients to safety and find Evans.
Could kind of feel myself starting to panic a little bit, but then training kicked in and it was, okay, let's look at our situation as it really is. So I went to just went through my ABCs, just figured it out. And so I knew I had 6 clients. I had 3 of us from a guiding point of view on a rock. We were in the middle of the crocodile infested Zambezi River. We had at this stage 2 canoes and 1 paddle. My radio, my first aid kit, my gun were all gone. It was dusk, and the chances of anyone looking for us anytime soon were pretty slim. And I knew Evans was in the somewhere nearby. He could have been laying on the bank in a similar condition to me, so we needed to rescue him. Mm-hmm. Time was of the essence.
Paul told Mac to stay with the clients while he and Ben would go to the extraction point and get help.
I fully expected Ben to say, no way, I'm not getting back in the river, because the hippo was still sitting there, like, Ben just defied the odds. I spoke about Mac's courage rescuing me. Ben to get back into that canoe with me was something else.
And was the hippo like right below you on the rocks, or like where?
Yeah.
So how did you even get in?
So what we did is we put the canoe where he couldn't get to. So the hippo was maybe a dozen feet away, and they put me in the canoe, and then Ben got in. And I had a little bit of a moment, I will admit. I was like, hey, Mac, please tell my family I'm sorry and that I love them. And he was like, nah, mate, you tell them yourself. And he eased us into the current. And we went past the hippo, and the hippo came and he bumped the canoe a few times and did his threat displays of like, And at this stage, I was just laying in the canoe and there was as much blood as water in it. And I knew at this stage I was weak. And if the hippo knocked us back in the water, I knew my chances were not good. So if you can picture it, I'm laying in the bottom of this canoe. I got all these bites on me. The hippo's bumping the canoe. There's a degree of fear.
Not just intense fear. This is also where the pain started kicking in.
Up until then, it hadn't been too bad, but now it's starting to make itself known. I remember having this moment, this absolute clarity, this sense of almost otherworldly peace. Just everything felt okay and clear, and a very clear moment of choice. Do I go or do I stay? I shut my eyes and drift off and call it a day? Or do I fight my way through this and stick around? I can remember laying there and choosing to stick around. And I remember it being a very distinct choice. And the reason I remember that is because when I made that choice, my body was filled with so much pain that I didn't think I could handle it. I was like, I can't do this. But I think at that moment, I knew I wasn't going to die.
On their way down the river, they kept an intense watch out for Evans. But there was no sign of him by the time they got to the extraction point. In a turn of luck, a medical air rescue service team had been training nearby. They were radioed and came to help Paul. They weren't able to fly Paul out. The air pressure changes would have been too much for his damaged chest cavity. So they loaded him into a vehicle and drove. The doctor with Paul told him he had been given pain meds, but they hadn't given him anything. The pain meds would put him to sleep, and they needed to keep Paul awake to monitor his head and spinal injuries. After 8 long hours of driving, they arrived at the hospital.
The surgeon, this incredible doctor, Dr. Nube, he's a Matabele guy. He was brilliant. And he told me afterwards that when he came in pre-op, because apparently who knew you had to authorize chopping limbs off. His strategy was, he admitted he didn't think I was going to live, but the one chance he thought I had was take off both arms and one leg. Instead, he said he came, and apparently I looked up at him and I said, "Doc, I know you're going to do what you got to do, but what do you say you take the minimalist approach?" And he told me afterwards that he thought, he's like, you know what, if this kid's going to, he goes, "The odds are I was going to die anyway." He said, really, when they had gotten to me, apparently the amount of blood I had left in me was incompatible with life. At this stage, I was playing with casino money. And so he's like, okay. So he went for the way, way, way more complex surgery and managed to keep one arm and both my legs on.
Paul's mom was called, and she jumped on a plane across Zimbabwe to be with him in the hospital.
Can you tell me the first conversation you had with her?
Yeah, that wasn't good. So my mom had never been a fan of me and safaris. She was like, "Paul, can't you just find a job that doesn't, like, you're not going to get killed at?" And I'd gone up to Victoria Falls to, like I mentioned earlier, to take care of some problem animal control, those lions that were eating those villages. So she didn't know that I was back on the river. So when I gained consciousness at one point and I saw her sitting there, I'm not stupid. I could see the angst and the pain and the concern on her. I was just like, "Oh, Mom, I'm so sorry." Yeah, that wasn't great. That was probably one of the worst moments of it. She was scared. She had every right to be scared. And I knew I'd put her in that position.
It was his mom that noticed a strange smell coming from Paul's amputated arm. The smell was gas gangrene, a highly deadly and rapidly spreading infection. This meant he had to have his left arm further amputated to the shoulder. The surgery was successful, and it seemed Paul was out of the woods. He just needed to rest and heal. But Paul was pissed off. He lost his arm and had gotten the news that Evans Namasango hadn't made it. Evans was just 22 years old.
Once I was stable, I just felt sorry for myself and pissed off at the world, guilty that found Evans' body a couple days after our attack. Wasn't a scratch on him, he'd drowned. I knew it was an accident, but I felt responsible. So I was this hodgepodge of emotions and pretty revolting to be about, truth be told. And one of the ways that it was a little church hospital, one of the ways that the nuns would deal with me when I became really revolting was to put me in this little courtyard in a wheelchair. Because if you're in a wheelchair and you've only got one arm, it doesn't matter how angry you are, you're going round and round in circles.
Then his surgeon paid him a visit.
This is Dr. Nube again. Okay. He came one day after I'd been particularly revolting, and I can remember him just sitting next to my bed, and he said, "Paul," he's like, "we've gone through how you shouldn't still be here." He goes, "but remember this, you're the sum of your choices. You're exactly who, what, and where you choose to be in life." And I can still vividly remember laying there being kind of pissed at him and thinking, "that's real easy for you to say, Doc. You're not the one lying here with bits and pieces missing." But I think deep down, I knew that he was right. You know, it was far easier for me to blame everyone and everything else for all of the things that had gone on and were going on in my life than to accept I was where I was and I needed to choose what happened next.
This idea of choosing what happens next, having your feelings, but choosing your next actions, has become sort of a mantra for Paul. But it's one thing to come to terms with the cards life has dealt you. It was an entirely different thing for Paul to accept that he had made it and Evans didn't.
How do you feel about survivor's guilt?
I feel like it's a very, very, very real thing and was incredibly debilitating for a really long time. I think I got over my loss of my arm and my life as I knew it far more easily and far quicker than I got over surviving and Evans dying. What happened that day on the Zambezi was an accident. We all went in from a guiding point of view with our eyes wide open. We were the ones who were encroaching on the wildlife. Mm-hmm. We totally knew that, and we did that willingly and knowingly. We all chose to be in the river. We chose to show up the way we showed up in the river that day. And that's not saying mistakes weren't made. And there was a part of me that was kind of pissed about that, because they weren't my mistakes. I'd gone in to clean things up. And that was an unhealthy place for me to be. And that was just me trying to strike out and try and make sense of something that made no sense to me. But that was part of my probably recovery process.
Can you talk about, we've talked about this a little bit already, but just the process of coming to terms with the life you thought you were going to have is going to be different than what actually happens now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think one of the things that helped with that process a lot, Caitlin, was after I lost my arm and I went through the whole, okay, let's put him back together again routine, I decided to put together an expedition team to canoe the Zambezi from source to sea.
The Zambezi River starts in Zambia and runs nearly 1,600 miles, ending in the Indian Ocean.
And in part, it was because it had never been done before. And in part, it was because there was a lot of publicity around what had happened to me. And I was really fortunate in that I had the resources to get prosthesis and to get medical help and all of that. In that part of the world at the time, who weren't as fortunate.
Landmines were still a huge problem in this region. The expedition was planned for 1998, 1 year after Princess Diana made her famous walk through a minefield in Angola.
So part of the plan became, let's use the Source to Sea expedition first ascent as a publicity vehicle to launch a 501c3 foundation, which can then go and help put limbs on kids who are getting blown up. So it brought like a sense of purpose and meaning that was bigger than me. Unfortunately, on the expedition, I thought like leading the first ascent on the Zambezi would prove to me that I wasn't disabled, but it actually did the exact opposite. It proved to me that I had a different life ahead of me. And there were a couple of occasions on that expedition where my ego and my unwillingness to accept my limitations almost killed me, and on one occasion in particular almost killed one of my teammates who had to come and rescue me.
Can you talk about that? What happened?
Yeah, we were paddling along, and so I had my paddle was strapped to my arm, and we were in these two-man kayaks. And we went into a rapid and went over and got pinned upside down. And because of the force of the water on my paddle, I couldn't get my arm down, and I was wedged into my kayak. So I'm wedged in upside down, getting thrashed in the rapid. The other guy in the boat washed out of the back, saw I wasn't there, and came back in and got sucked under in the rapid, but managed to get to where I was and pulled me out.
But they made it through the expedition. Before they left, Paul had discovered a particular incentive to come out the other end alive. Paul had insisted on having a journalist on the expedition team.
And the journalist we hired was an American. Before we left on the expedition, he said, come and meet my family.
This family dinner included the journalist's sister, Carrie, who Paul fell in love with almost immediately.
So after the expedition, she didn't want to live in Africa and I didn't want to live without her. So I moved to the States. I think just time and distance and space. And I think I was just really lucky when I got married, it was truly a chance for a new beginning. People didn't know me here and I could kind of reinvent.
Paul married Carrie, had daughters Caitlin and Aaron, and son Jack to round out the three. Aaron had health issues early on in life that we'll talk about a little later. But on top of that stress, Paul continued to work nonstop for the next 10 years. By 2017, Paul's body finally said enough.
So a couple of years before I got really sick, I ended up in hospital with blood clots. My work schedule, I was traveling a lot, speaking a lot, leading conferences, coaching, blah, 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 blah. And I wasn't taking really good care of myself. I thought I was, but I really wasn't. And there's this fun thing called an allostatic load. It's the cumulative kind of effect of stress, like building, 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 building. And not surprisingly, when we keep doing that to ourselves, our bodies start breaking down. I can remember, this is quite literally the conversation the doctor had with me as I was sitting, laying in a hospital with blood thinners, with blood clots, was if you don't change your lifestyle, they're going to inscribe death by stupid on your headstone. You think it's cute, but it's not. It was absolutely everywhere. I was trying to pull it up. They started with like my viral loads, and then they talked about areas where there was cancer that was just starting off. And then there were areas that had cancer that was aggressive. And then there were areas that were inflamed. And it was just this, it just kept going and going and going.
At the same time that was going on,
it turned out that, how should I put this? My wife at the time decided she wanted to take her life in a different direction. So I was sick, had a marriage that was falling apart, or had fallen apart.
Paul decided to tackle his illness from a few different angles, starting with a full body assessment from Dr. Tom Schultz at the New York Center of Innovative Medicine. Then trips to Jerusalem for spirituality and Nepal to explore what love means, and visiting a healer his friend recommended in the Amazon. And then back to the New York Center of Innovative Medicine for treatment.
I don't even pretend to know what they did to me. There was a lot of really smart science and a lot of really cool stuff. But what I do know is about it, a year after finding out that I was in trouble, I was sitting in Chicago and I got a call from Dr. Tom. They had just run another set of tests. And he said, seriously, you're good to go. It's all gone. There's nothing. And so I do that thing every year. I go and get a battery of tests and we keep an eye out. But it's been quite a few years now with Clean Bill of Health. But what I need to go back to is at the same time, I was doing a lot of this work on mental health, allostatic loads, the impact of stress on our biology and our physiology, which was also part of their approach. And the funny thing was, it didn't matter if I was in Israel speaking to rabbis or priests or in Jerusalem, or if I was in Kathmandu or up in the mountains in the Himalayas, or if I was in the middle of the Amazon, when I would ask the question of how do I get to live, they all had the same answer. They may have used different words, but it was all around be grateful for what you have, gratitude, and then be kind. Be kind to yourself and be kind to others. And then just do the next right thing. As corny as that sounds, if at that time there were a lot of things the doctors were telling me to do from a nutritional point of view, from a treatment point of view, the next right thing often wasn't things that I wanted to do, but they were things that I needed to do if I wanted to live. And I think they taught me I don't have to swing to the bleachers. Base hits work. Just do the next right thing and then the next right thing.
I would love to tell you that Paul has slowed down and learned that regular old life can be all the adventure he needs. But I can't.
Gosh, I mean, At what point are you like, this is enough, that I can't be putting my life in danger like this anymore? Or have you even reached that point?
I was just about to say I could lie, but I literally just got back from running the marathon de Sable. This was my third attempt. What it is you run ballpark. Okay, so you're running through the Sahara Desert with everything on your back, all your food for a week. You do a marathon the first day, marathon the second day, double marathon the next day, then a marathon. So it's supposed to be the toughest foot race in the world. The first time I did it, I got to day four and septicemia shut me down. My feet had got infected and septic, and then my body shut down. The next year I went, I got a heat stroke 3 days into it and ended up on a bunch of IVs. And this year I actually got to the finish line. This year I finished it. I got talked into that by a friend who then dropped out. And
your friends are bad influences.
They really are.
You need a friend that's like, you know what's nice? A pool. Just
yeah.
Sitting there.
I do need some friends like that.
I personally hate the phrase, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But all the bad stuff that Paul lived through up to this point did help him prepare for what I hope, for his sake, is the worst thing that will ever happen to him.
If I hadn't survived all of that, then I wouldn't have been able to navigate my daughter's death.
Paul's daughter, Erin, died in June of 2020 from a seizure. She was diagnosed with infantile spasms at 4 months old and had epilepsy the rest of her life.
When she was born, things went south pretty early. She had a lot of challenges. It was very touch and go if she was going to live when she was a baby. And we were incredibly blessed that she did get to live till just a few years ago during COVID into her teens. But living with a child who's medically fragile and has profound special needs brought with it its own unique set of challenges. And so when people would say, yeah, you get to choose what happens next, in that environment, I'd be like, really?
Yeah. But it's so much harder than that. Oh, I just choose to not let this bother me.
Right.
Was it that easy for you? Were you just like, oh, well, okay, you're right. It is a choice. I'm going to choose to be totally fine with this.
No. And it actually became a lot of my life's work, the last 20 years work on figuring out how to do that. But how do you actually do that on a current basis when life keeps getting in the way? You know, there was this philosopher who survived World War II going through the concentration camps, Viktor Frankl, and he talked about how between stimulus and response, so between stuff happening and how we respond, there's a gap. There's a space. And in that space lies our agency. That's where we get to choose what happens next. But even with our best intentions, if we've got a whole bunch of counterproductive brain patterns running, we've got a limited set of options. So how do we give people a broader set of patterns to access so they can choose productively? But I was living firsthand how difficult it was. And so it wasn't just a kind of suck it up, princess, and drive on, like, come on, snap out of it. Everyone would have if they could have. So I got fascinated, and then I just had the privilege of working with people who were doing a lot of research on trauma and stress and how people show up. I got to work with the US military, and I got to work with a lot of the leading thinkers and doers in this world. And along the way, got to learn about how our mind and our brain aren't always our best friends. And much like you can build a muscle to go for a run, you can build a muscle to choose what happens next.
But how difficult is that when you're at like the depths of your despair?
It's really tough, but it's not as tough as staying at the depths of despair. It can sound really plithy and arrogant and what have you. So I think a lot of this is in the delivery, but I think what I'm seeing is more and more today, this whole concept of applied neuroplasticity and the fact that our brains are malleable.
I'm hearing this and I'm agreeing with it, but I'm also like, I don't know if I could do it.
So here's a super quick experiment. So the very premise of it is you can't be grateful and grumpy at the same time. Okay. So your brain can't be doing both things at the same time, different set of neural networks. So think of someone or something in your life that you're grateful for.
Oh, no. Uh-oh. No, I'm going to cry. Because I'm thinking about, like, my mom died last year, and that's who I'm thinking of.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But, like, I'm grateful for my mom, but I'm also really sad that she's gone.
Can I have some space just for 30 seconds? Because I think something that happened to me might help you in this moment. So I can remember the day I found out that Aaron died. And I knew that I needed to drive to be with my Caitlin and my son and their mother. And I needed to show up in that space. But I was like devastated with the sadness of I just found out she died. And so I called a friend who was one of the scientists I was working with in the Brain Trust on this whole neuroplasticity thing. And he said, just think of a time that you were really grateful to have Aaron in your life. Think of stuff that you did that made you feel good. And I would focus on that. And he would be like, okay, what did it feel like? What were you doing? And as you're thinking about that and you're noticing how it feels, it's acting a part of your brain, and you can't be sad and grateful at the same time. And so it didn't mean that I wasn't mourning, and I do get those things, kind of like you do. There'll be times when I'll just be like, oh my gosh. But it's as accessible as a breath and a smile, because as corny as that sounds, that gratitude activates a different set of neural networks. And the beauty of it is when we go to gratitude, gratitude has an impact on your heart rate variability. Mm-hmm. And when you get grateful, there's actually more neuronal activity from your brain to your heart, from your heart to your brain than your brain to your heart. So getting grateful kicks off a whole different set of neurochemistry. So that despair we feel when we're sad, that's a bunch of automatic neurological function. And by getting grateful in a moment, we just cut it out. Stop that. Let's go to grateful. And do you have a chance to reset?
I love you, Mom, and I miss you very much. This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. You can follow the show on Instagram and TikTok at Live to Tell Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks.